One has to have extremely powerful reasons to uphold one's faith in this world, where it's not the norm. And yet then, if we bear witness to the deep, profound reasons of this is what gives ultimate meaning to my life, then people become curious. What do you have? What's the source of your happiness? What's the source of meaning in your life?
Welcome back to Religion to Reality. I'm your host, Dave Plisky. I'm joined by my friend and co-host, Father John Gribowicz, and this is the podcast about living an integrated life. This season is about us Catholics listening to what people of other faith traditions have to say. And we're right now in the middle of listening to a number of Buddhists. In this episode, we're going to hear from a Buddhist in the Tibetan tradition. She has practiced Zen Buddhism, which we've heard about in a number of the past few episodes. But that's not her focus right now. And at the same time that she's Buddhist, she's also a practicing Catholic, which is where we got the name for this episode, both. If this is your first episode with us, I hope that you came here because you are searching for Eva's name and you know what you're about to get into. Because if you just happen to want to get into our podcast and you're starting here, you're really kind of jumping off in the deep end on this one. And I mean that in a really good way, but it's definitely one of the more theologically advanced conversations that we have throughout the entire season. And it's one of those episodes where the beginning is not a slow start, but just let Eva get going and she can cook. Just wait, this is a powerhouse episode. So look, I listen to podcasts while I'm doing other things, just like the next guy, but this is one that you're going to be wanting to pay attention for. So here we go. Eva Natanya, PhD, is co-founder, vice president, and resident teacher at the Center for Contemplative Research. And I just want to say in advance that I'm going to do my best, but I am going to butcher some of these words in this bio. So apologies in advance. Eva is a scholar of Indian and Tibetan Buddhism, Christian theology, and comparative religion. She has served in many capacities as a spiritual teacher, academic lecturer, translator, and editor of Tibetan texts, writer, and retreat leader. Following a 9-year career as a professional ballet dancer with both the New York City Ballet and the Royal Ballet of England, she earned an MA in Christian Systematic Theology at the Graduate Theological Union with a thesis entitled Why Emptiness? Toward a Christian understanding of Madhyamika thought. She later earned a PhD in religious studies from the University of Virginia, where her dissertation examined the complex interactions of Madhyamika Yogacara and Abhidharma teachings as they underlie the Vajrayana philosophy of Jay Tsongkhapa. She has collaborated with Dr. B. Allen Wallace on translations for several books on Tibetan Buddhism, including Open Mind, View and Meditation on the Lineage of Lerab Lingpa, Fathoming the Mind, Inquiry and Insight in Dudjom Lingpa's Vajra Essence, and Samatha and Vispadhyana, an anthology of pith instructions, and has co-taught meditation retreats with Dr. Wallace in the US, Italy, Australia, and New Zealand. In a Christian context, she co-authored Living Resurrected Lives, What It Means and Why It Matters with Veronica Mary Rolfe. She has spent more than 4 years in solitary meditation retreat and currently serves as a resident teacher at the Center for Contemplative Research in Crestone, Colorado, while continuing her solitary retreat practice. Eva, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's really lovely to be meeting with all of you.
Likewise. So how do you and John know each other? Let's just start there.
Well, I think I first saw you when you said Mass at Incarnation Monastery several years ago, Father John. And wow. I remember you brought your guitar.
Oh, really? Oh, that's right. Yeah, I might have played a song after communion, maybe.
I think so.
That's right. Okay, I actually probably didn't even know you were there that day. But I mean, I knew your mom from the community there, and that's how we got to know each other more closely, if you want to. Maybe share a little bit about that, because your mom is a legend in her own right.
Yes. So as David mentioned, in the book that I co-authored with Veronica Mary Rolfe, Veronica Mary Rolfe is my mother. And it was a book that we worked on together for several years, actually. I mean, I won't go into the whole history of the book, but it was a profound collaboration and the culmination of many hundreds of conversations and meditations that we had shared together, both, with respect to her own explorations of scripture, in an earlier book called Suddenly There Is God, which really culminated in the scriptural teachings on resurrection. And she knew another book needed to come out of that on the resurrection. And then the reason that I most explicitly collaborated with her on this book, Living Resurrected Lives, is because theologically and philosophically, we needed to stretch the boundaries of even how resurrection had been worked with through the centuries. Like the book includes deep scriptural exegesis and then theological recap, as it were, of some of the major discussions and arguments that had occurred through history around what's the nature of resurrection, what gets resurrected in terms of the physical body, in terms of the spirit, in terms of the body-mind united. And quite unabashedly, we brought in Buddhist ideas that we had been discussing for, as I say, a couple decades, almost 2 decades by then. And then in part two of the book, there's a series of meditations that we had done spontaneously together, recorded, then she created a transcript, and then I re-recorded in retreat later, and that's available for those who purchase the book. And these meditations are very explicitly bringing visualization techniques, meditation techniques that I had certainly learned in a Buddhist context, and yet when they're brought to the scriptural experience of the resurrection of the apostles in the days and weeks after the resurrection, I think for any Christian listening, it's perfectly obvious these are Christian meditations, and they have an Ignatian quality to them, actually, of putting oneself in that place and time. But I knew very well what I was bringing to it from a Buddhist context. And it was almost like an experiment of how utterly Christian can we make these meditations? And I've received some really wonderful feedback about it from individual practitioners who've been able to benefit from those meditations and then making them their own in their own practice.
What are some of the main Buddhist ideas that you brought to your treatment of the resurrection that Christians might not have had, coming in with just a Christian background?
Wow. Well, this is kind of diving to the the deepest part with not too much background yet.
We can save it if you...
I think so. I think I need to say more about this word Madhyamaka, the middle way philosophy in Buddhism, about the meaning of emptiness in Buddhism, which is so often misunderstood, the understanding of body-mind connection. Yeah, it's a lot that goes into what I expressed there as an intro.
Okay, then let me give you this question, which will pull us even more back. These books you wrote with your mother, so I'd love to hear just a little bit about your story, how you're growing up, and if Christianity and Buddhism were always present together for you, or if that evolved, or how that happened in your life.
So no, my interest in Buddhism was something of an anomaly in our family. Though my mother was certainly the first person to give me some books on Zen. I think Zen Catholicism by Dom Alred Graham, which she'd been reading in the 60s. And she gave me her copy when I was, probably in my early teens, and that would have been by the early 90s. And then she gave me some contemporary books on Zen, including the famous Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, when I was in my late teens. And I should add, at that point, I had already entered the New York City Ballet at the age of 16, and I was a full-time performer, 16, 17, 18 years old, and dealing with the intense exertion, pressure, psychological, physical demands of that career. And as you can probably already tell, my mother's her faith and lifelong, and so I should say, my mother passed away this past September, and that was part of how Father John and I got to know each other better, around her illness and her passing. But she is, of course, very present with me always. And so her life was one of profound devotion, a contemplative practice that she honed herself over the course of decades. I mean, she was a seeker from very early. And my brother and I have a vivid memory of childhood when we would come be driving back from Mass, and we were at a Newman Center, which was very forward thinking, forward working in the 80s, a college campus Newman Center. But she would give what we called the sermon after the sermon. And so we would hear our mom's perspective on the Gospels. And she was very much a spiritual teacher for both my brother and myself. And she was reading Théard de Jardin's The Divine Milieu to me when I was 12 years old. So it was kind of like just taking me into the deep end of what a mystical vision of life might look like. And it seems to me, probably around the same time, because of course both my parents were exposing me to a broad world of history, culture, diversity. And as we watched some programs, I think when my mid-teens, the Bill Moyers program on the world religions came out with Houston Smith, and just the fascination, the love that I felt of, oh, this is so holy, this is so sacred, and these people look so different from the Catholic world I was being raised in. And the question started to formulate, I think, in different stages over my teenage. Well, first of all, what if I'd been born in China with to Chinese parents and hadn't heard about Christianity and had been raised in, let's say, Buddhism, let's say Confucianism, and that was my worldview? How would I know that that wasn't truth? Or maybe it would be truth? It was that real deep question of the potential relativity of cultural background and training, of what one thinks is the entire scope of truth. And I knew that for Christian faith to reach its depths in me, I didn't need to think that it was coming just from the circumstantial contingencies of my birth and my family. And I wasn't rebelling against that. I think it's very important to say I had a wonderful experience of Catholicism growing up. My father's Jewish, so that's why I'm referring so much to my mother in terms of our Catholic upbringing. And it was utterly mutual that my parents had agreed early on that my mom would be responsible for the raising of my brother and myself in faith. So it was more the enormous question of truth and how do I know that cultural limitations aren't stopping me from understanding the whole of the truth. And later in teenage, I know that I was already in New York City Valley living on my own by then, that the thought came, well, what if Jesus had been born, lived, preached, worked miracles, died, and was resurrected in India, in a completely different cultural, philosophical context? And over the years, it wasn't that that was a so much a what if question historically, because that's kind of a moot point. It didn't happen that way. But it was more of the exploratory question of, especially as I started to learn more about the history of theology and the development of theology and the contingencies around that, the linguistic cultural contingencies, even around the terms, the Greek terms, the Latin terms that were debated and misunderstood across different groups in the early church and hammered out in the councils, but understanding the contingencies around even the groups that didn't agree in the end to the Chalcedonian definition, for example. And there were political factors there, we know that. But there were also linguistic and cultural factors. And so the question lingered more in the sense of what now? As the world has expanded so radically, and Christianity is being practiced, being lived in cultures to which at some level it's still foreign. And we have exposure globally to religious traditions that medieval European Christianity had no clue about
Let alone
thinking of.
antiquity, yeah.
Let alone antiquity. Though in a way that seems there was more cultural exchange of religion in the second, third, fourth century than there was by the 12th, 13th, 14th. So this is a very long arc that I'm trying to express, but I think you get where I'm going, which is given the strong influence of Greek philosophical systems, as well as Judaic understanding, especially of the body, of the mind, of what happens at death, whether there's the possibility of a resurrection, a general resurrection at the end of time, the Abrahamic understanding of creation, this was the womb, I won't say container, but the womb in which Christianity developed as an understanding and interpretation of the events.
Right.
And if those events had taken place in an entirely different culture, or now, if from the perspective of an entirely different culture and even religious system, philosophical system, worldview system, we look again as a kind of a ressourcement, aggiornamento, to look again at the events as we have them so faithfully. I mean, I faithfully recorded in the Gospels, and I think that's important for me to point out. I'm not the kind of, my approach has not been one of let's deconstruct the very roots of Christianity. I have not had much interest actually in even the historical Jesus movement or other retellings as if they got it wrong, because I don't believe they got it wrong. I believe that the church tradition is profound, and in as best we can have as a historical representation of events that were already being interpreted as soon as they occurred. But it's more that expansion question of when Christians in India, even now, and of course Christianity has been in India for more than 2,000 years, or maybe about 2,000 years, if it's true that St. Thomas went all the way to India. Are there philosophical structures within which Indians, Chinese, Japanese, and so on can understand the Christian story that doesn't feel like an import, that is actually germane to the philosophies that have been with that culture for generations? So I'm still speaking of a certain stage of that questioning in my own life. As I started to learn more and study more, I felt a distinctive pull to Buddhism. I've studied a great deal about Hindu religion and the diversity of Hindu religion and philosophy in my life, but even by the time I was in graduate school, I was doing so from the perspective of a Buddhist scholar, a Buddhist practitioner looking at Hinduism. I've never felt that I was within that tradition, whereas my path has brought me deep into Buddhism as an insider. And the more I became an insider within Buddhism, and particularly the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, the very way I was formulating those questions changed.
Yeah, like because now you're experiencing the... exactly what you're talking about in reverse, right?
Exactly. And so that path, of course, we could talk for hours about being Christian as a Buddhist, because I don't even like the hyphenated things. Those things, they kind of didn't work after a while.
I want to hear what John has to say, but one thing that you made me think of is possibly, just really kind of blew my mind for a second. What I'm going to suggest that you maybe think of, Eva, Richard Rohr has this idea that Christianity is taking its really sweet time to mature, that we seem to, like, in terms of like a person maturing, Christianity as a tradition seems to mature about 1 year for every century that it grows. And so we're about 21. Finally, we're about to like be able to, you know, drink, and
we're legal.
But I just wonder, like, another thing that Father John and I talk about a lot is like second half of life spirituality, right? Mm-hmm. Where you are, everyone has to grow up in some kind of container. And so, you know, for many people listening, that there's probably a Christian container of some sort, but it could be anything. And we're faced at some point, usually through tragedy or some kind of event that makes us reconsider everything. And there are three effective options that we end up having before we kind of go on. And this sort of determines what our second half of life spirituality might look like. Mm-hmm. One is to batten down the hatches and say, okay, this is all, this is the truth. This is all there is. And I'm going to be in this sort of this narrow, like, church centric sort of approach. The other kind of drastic approach is to say, none of this is true. I'm leaving the tradition altogether and throwing out the container. And the third, and I think most fruitful, and what we're hoping people can do option is to keep the container, but grow out of it, right? Just the way that plants are supposed to kind of blossom and flower and so forth. Like they don't leave their pot, but they do branch out. Mm-hmm. And I just wonder if Christianity is at this moment, certainly not in its second half of life, if it's only 21 years old. But I wonder if Christianity we could say that it's starting to grow out of its container, you know, because of all the things, the globalization of the world and people like you who are not hyphenated, but following both of these paths and in an integrated way. It's not, I doubt that you feel like you're Christian today and Buddhist the next, right? This is a very integrated idea. I don't know, just throwing it out there that I wonder if like we as a faith tradition, I mean, that's kind of what the point of the season is about.
Yeah. Mm. I think it will take enormous courage on the part of the global church with the myriad communities that make up that global church, that the world demands it. That for the glory, and I want to say the majesty of the Christian vision, of the divine ground, of the speaking of the word from all eternity, of the giving of the word to humanity in incarnation in order to draw humanity back to itself. I mean, these mystical understandings of the Christian theological foundation are sublime. And you can tell the love and the passion that I feel in saying that I wouldn't want the world to lose that for a pared down, externalized version of Christianity that people think of as just the things you have to do to stay on the right side of the law, as it were. A kind of a legalistic Christianity that's about just do what you have to do in order to get to heaven. And I think, frankly, in my generation at least, and probably even more so in younger generations, that just doesn't fly anymore. You can't uphold that as a reason to maintain a faith tradition in a world that is where that's no longer the norm. One has to have extremely powerful reasons to uphold one's faith in this world where it's not the norm. And yet then, if we bear witness to the deep, profound reasons of this is what gives ultimate meaning to my life, then people become curious. What do you have? What's the source of your happiness? What's the source of meaning in your life? So I believe it was Karl Rahner, right, who said in the coming years, unless we will either be mystics or we will not be Christians at all. Something like that, right?
Right.
That he had a foretaste of how the church would need to grow. And I think in this age of globalization and cross-cultural pollination, and where Christianity is under siege and being destroyed in some of its earliest homes, even right now, you know, that it has to be able to reach its arms beyond what it even thought were its limits.
Yeah. And, you know, let's just try to unpack that a little bit, because I think this is something that I know that you, Eva, and I have talked about offline in the sense that, you know, a deepening awareness of the incarnation is, I think, what is at the heart of this, that somehow everything is participating in the incarnation. Everything is only exists because of the incarnation. There is a wholeness of all everything that is human and everything that is divine, which is ultimately one reality. And I know that's a very maybe big thing to kind of think about or try to be able to kind of even grasp your head around. But it's the only thing that ultimately makes sense when you get to it, because otherwise you fall into different patterns of dualism or ways to kind of or if anything just a sense of tribalism of certain people who get it and other people don't get it, so to speak, when it comes to like the truth and just having all these different types of debates ever as to what is the truth. But when there's a sense that everything is participating in the truth, it's a different type of paradigm shift that starts to emerge. But it's a big challenge because, I mean, even in very sophisticated academic quarters of the church, I mean, there's so much emphasis placed on define dogma and just how things are go through a process in the tradition to reach that definition. And it seems to be the reality that once things are somewhat defined, or once they are at least codified in a certain way, they become like impenetrable, or they become such almost idols in themselves that it's hard to kind of be able to do anything to maybe deepen them even. And I just maybe if you could speak a little bit about that, because I know that when I was younger, let's just say in high school and college, when I was first really getting into learning about theology, it was far easier for me to just be able to kind of have a black and white look at things, because you just are trying to really solidify the container so much. You want to be able to know what the parameters are, like what are the rules of this game, so to speak, called life, and how am I supposed to best play the game by following the rules? And then when something happens, as Dave was saying, where the rules don't seem to kind of really help the situation that's been presented to you because of let's just say, a particular type of suffering or a wound or just some type of tragedy. Or like at that point, I mean, how much are you able to recognize that the very presence of God is far greater than the rules of the game or the parameters of where the game is played? That, you know, the things that we thought were just going to be the prescribed way of looking at everything, that doesn't actually maybe help us in the moment when there are other things that are being presented to us, which we have to open ourselves up to. But that takes a lot of courage to do that, because you may feel as if you're doing something that's almost kind of almost traitorous. Like you're almost kind of like going against something that you thought was so sacrosanct. So I don't know if this makes sense how I'm trying to say it, but I just like to kind of get it out there, because I think that the work that you've done and your experience of just really just immersing yourself into so many different traditions, you have been able to kind of create this incredible integration where there's nothing to be feared in how you engage the spiritual life. And I think there's a lot of fear that happens, especially, I'm going to say, amongst Catholics, when you seem to be coloring outside the lines, you know? So like, I know I said a lot, but I don't know if there's anything that you can latch on there that maybe resonates in any way or you can add to.
Yeah, for sure. I think I'll start with the point about fear, because of course that's something I dealt with probably most vividly in my early 20s. So actually, I'll backtrack for a moment. When I was practicing Zen, and of course this was concurrent with the years as I was a professional ballet dancer. So when most people would go to a Zen one day sit maybe every week or every month, I think I only remember two or three one-day sits, and then I was so excited when I finally had the opportunity to do a seven-day sesshin at the Green Gulch Zen Center outside of San Francisco. And then, yeah, it was a week of work and then a week of the 7 days sesshin, and that was life-changing for me. But it had to be so compact because I didn't have free time. But it also meant that I was creating my own practice through a lot of fatigue and post-performance exhaustion and so on. But it was the counterbalance for this incredibly aesthetic, performance-oriented part of my life, and then the mystical, intellectual, conceptual all on the other side of that balance. But as long as I was practicing Zen, I knew there was a little bit of a charted territory for Zen and Catholicism. It had this is the early 2000s, so it had been done already for several decades, that I knew there were deeply respected Catholics, especially Catholic priests, even who had become Zen Roshis. And especially because in the Zen tradition of Buddhism, as it grew in China and later Japan, almost so explicitly eschewed discussion of Buddhist tenets as part of practice. It's not that they didn't have them. And of course, the Zen tradition is deeply rooted in Mahayana sutras, Mahayana teachings. And maybe this had to do with even the way it was taught in America, of the Japanese, Korean, Vietnamese Zen masters who had come to this country, and they knew people didn't necessarily want to know the whole story of Buddhism, but they wanted to practice. And so it was so practice oriented that it seemed quite obvious. Well, of course, I can sit in this apophatic kind of meditation that's releasing all imagery, releasing the very desire to know and to question and to have an answer. But this is purifying my mind and spirit. That felt quite obvious in terms of Zen. But I remember asking more than one Zen teacher in the New York area, is it justified for me to be doing this practice as a Christian with Christian goals when I'm not giving myself to it in entirely the same way that Buddhists have for centuries? And I received various very deep and insightful Zen answers. Sorry to say it that way, but they didn't satisfy the very real existential question that I had. And I, even as I say it, I can feel the tears come, because it wasn't a question that needed to be sideswiped at that time. It was a question that needed to be addressed directly. For me, I'm just saying, as my own path. And it was when I encountered the Tibetan tradition of Buddhism, which is as intellectually rigorous as any scholastic philosophy of the Thomistic tradition, the Dominican tradition, et cetera, within Christianity. And I saw that, oh, here's a Buddhism that's full on philosophical. And it's not the same. And it's going to challenge me to the depths of what I think reality is, and therefore what I think God means. But at least it gave me a pathway to ask those questions and not feel that I was undercutting the question before it had even fully formulated. I certainly hope I'm not offending anyone in the way I say that, but it was just like, I needed to go head on.
And for you, that was justification. That's what you meant by that? Because that's an interesting word that you used when you said, am I justified in doing this?
Yeah, so it was that by starting a more detailed study in Tibetan Buddhism, where I knew I had so much content to learn and techniques to learn, I didn't feel that I was using someone else's practice, as it were, Zen Buddhist practice, for a different purpose, namely Christian insight.
I see what you mean.
I felt like, okay, there's an authenticity here. And I know it's dangerous to use that word right now, and I really mean it, as in authenticity of my faith in Christ is deep. And this is something I need to add, actually, to the whole question of fear. If someone can sincerely in prayer feel they are being guided into that path by the Lord, that's a very different experience than pushing the church, the Lord, the whole of it away in order to seek. And I knew in my heart that I was asking the Lord to guide me on that path. And there was a kind of an imperative there, a strong imperative of, yes, this is the direction you need to go. These are the questions you need to ask. And so when I say onto authenticity, in that I was bringing the debate to the foreground rather than pushing it into the background, of simply a non-conceptual practice. And I think that then over time, that became one of my concerns about the mode of interreligious dialogue as it has been practiced and admirably practiced for some decades now. But I was aware that the very effort to embrace and to sit in silence together, as the phrase goes, and to simply be at peace and admiring the virtuous qualities of another group. From accounts I read of certain conferences and so on, like monastic interreligious dialogue, and this is already decades ago, I was always a little bit saddened that it hadn't gone deeper into the real, as what I saw to be the real questions, the tough questions, the dangerous questions. you see what I'm saying?
Totally. You're reminding me of a, and I don't want to reduce what you're saying at all. This is a little bit more simplistic, I guess. But I couldn't appreciate Andy Warhol's art for quite a while until I went and saw some of his early work at an exhibition that a museum was doing. I think it was Brooklyn Museum. And it was showing some of his early sketches. It was way before his pop art phase. Mm-hmm. And I was like, whoa, okay, this in my mind, this is my naivete and my own biases coming up more than anything. But I was thinking to myself, oh, he is an artist. I wouldn't have put him in that category yet, as if the other art, pop art that he was doing didn't count or something, because it wasn't technically what, you know. So, you know what I think of as someone who's not a visual artist, I'm a musician, but not a visual artist, is to say, well, if I could do it, it's not good art. it's not impressing me. You know, and I saw some of his early work that I definitely couldn't have done, and I suddenly had a greater appreciation even for the later stuff, because now I understood, oh, he put his time in, he did the work, and all that. By the way, our listeners can't see this, of course, but I have a poster behind me. It's technically made of Legos. That is kind of an homage to Roy Lichtenstein's pop art work. So I'm clearly come a long way in my appreciation for pop art. But but I bring this up because I wonder, it kind of reminds me of what you're saying about, you know, the scaffolding of all that philosophical tradition was always there within Zen. It just wasn't being emphasized. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until you reached the Tibetan branch that you got to see it in its glory, and maybe even you appreciate Zen more because of it, I wonder.
Definitely. There have been profound moments of that over the years. I mean, I'm not associated with any particular Zen tradition now. I haven't practiced in that context for a very long time. But echoes or quotation from Dogen and so on meant so much more once I had studied Madhyamaka in its Indian and Tibetan formulations. And then I understood what all the contradictions, the apparent contradictions of language were about. I understood so much more about what the poetry is trying to pull apart. And it's different pathways for different people, of course. And I should add just briefly, in the last 9 years or so, once I immersed myself in the Dzogchen tradition, which means the great perfection tradition, which reached its flourishing in Tibet. But historically, there may have been some connections between forms of Chan, Chinese Chan Buddhism, and early Dzogchen. I'm talking like 1,000 years ago or more. It gave me even more appreciation of what the authentic roots of Zen would have been and where the truly realized masters were coming from, in terms of the ineffable ground that is realized. That's a whole topic of its own. But in terms of the philosophical tradition, of course, His Holiness the Dalai Lama has emphasized this throughout his lifetime of teaching, which is the Tibetan tradition traces itself back to the Nalanda tradition. Nalanda was one of the great monastic universities of India. And it was a university in the sense that we want a university to be, which is the sheer diversity of backgrounds, of teachers, of philosophical views that were debated, the whole notion of the four philosophical schools within Buddhism, that grew out of centuries of great masters within the Indian Buddhist university tradition, Vikramalashila, Nalanda, the two most famous perhaps. And it's that tradition that made its way to Tibet Yeah, there are historical circumstances around this. Why, in one of the most intensive translation projects of history, Imperial Tibet translated, they even created a Tibetan script in order to translate the Sanskrit Indian scriptures into Tibetan in the course of maybe 100, 150 years. And that then served as the scriptural foundation. And then there's a lot more to that story I don't need to go into now. I need to say something, I think, about what Madhyamaka philosophy actually says, where it leads us, because that's also the doorway to breaking open the boundaries of fear. And as you were saying, Father John, about how to hold dogma and the beauty of established dogma, but with a lighter touch that's able to allow it more like art. To show one deeper and deeper nuances without getting stuck and without getting rigid. And of course, we know anyone who's studied the Christian tradition, and not only the Latin and what became the Western European tradition, but the diversity of the early church and the Syriac tradition and the Byzantine tradition, and then, the early Roman, later Roman tradition. The kind of diversity that we even have within Christianity is something I think would benefit a lot of people to study in the first place. I mean, let alone going outside of Christianity. That's one thing I wanted to say today is for Catholics, just to go to a Byzantine Catholic church and say, oh, this fulfills my obligations. This is completely in union with Rome, but wow, the liturgy of St. John Chrysostom is different from the Latin Rite. And just to be exposed to that first step, I think, of there's more to the church than most people thought, much less to see something of what Coptic Christianity, Syriac Christianity, has looked like. And there's so much information at our fingertips now. I really encourage people to just explore. But then to come to emptiness, which it's a difficult translation, but it really is probably the only correct one because shunyata, maybe you've heard that word, is a Sanskrit word. Shunya actually is, it means zero. It's that kind of absence, the absence mathematically. And shunyata is the very essence of absence. So, and in Tibetan language, tongpa ni. Tongpa is used in all the same ways that the English word empty is used. You can say that a cup is empty of liquid and it's tongpa. So it is a very ordinary word in that sense. And then the ni is the translation of the ta in Sanskrit. And that's the actual nature of emptiness, the very being of, the very essence of emptiness or being empty. And so when it's used that way, it is not ordinary emptiness, as in one thing is empty of something else. It's profound metaphysical existential emptiness, as in anything you focus upon, any phenomena you take as an example, if you look deeply enough, you will find that its essence is not to be found. That any true nature, and this phrase from its own side, as in it would be the same from all perspectives. If you're looking for a nature of something, that no matter who looked at it in any time, in any place, from any perspective, it would always be the same. That idea of real nature, no matter what you look at, you won't find it. And yeah, it actually can be explained quite simply, even though it's thousands of years of exposition of that philosophical. And it's actually an absence of a position, too, because what are known as the prasangikas, the consequence school of the middle way, it's an argument ad absurdum where they don't ever give their logical inferential reasoning, of which there will be a conclusion. Rather, they turn their opponent's argument on its head. So they show you. By rhetorical questions sometimes, or leading you to your ultimate conclusion, oh, really? Is that where you're going to go with that? Can you hold that position? So I think in our postmodern era, it's so easy to show people that with respect to artificial systems, right? Digital systems, et cetera. Everybody knows you break it down to its tiniest components and you won't find the thing anymore. Systems come into being through their interactions and through their being understood in a certain way from a certain perspective. So that's, it's almost easier in our day and age to understand that for various reasons. Post deconstructionism from a literary theory point of view, digital systems and so on. But the scary thing is to bring that kind of argumentation to the tenets of religion itself. To say, can I take that which I hold most dear, which I cherish, and look more and more and more deeply and see there is a provisional quality, even to the expression of doctrine, because it is expressing something, let's say, in the case of Christianity, for human beings. It's expressing that truth in a way that makes sense to human beings. The incarnational revelation of God to the animals isn't going to be doctrinally expressed that way. I mean, it's almost absurd to say it because it's so obvious, but it's pointing that we want to, yes, and from a Christian point of view, one wants to be able to say, oh, if it's true, it's always true. This is the revealed doctrine forever. But to be able to see that something can be true in a provisional way that works, that functions, that not negating it in a sense of just a relativism, my truth is as good as your truth. Not that, because Buddhism actually rejects that kind of relativism as dangerous, as an ethical, ultimately an ethical relativism, which is catastrophic. But rather, can you hold it at this as precious at the same time as seeing it as empty? And then revelation, frankly, takes on an illusory quality. I mean, the word illusion is loaded in Buddhism. It's a really powerful word. And it's used positively as well as negatively. But that can one see an illusory doctrine, even, that is still teaching us in a way that leads us in the right direction and not the wrong direction? So in Vajrayana, which is generally accepted as the pinnacle of Buddhist teachings. Even that I can't say definitively because Chinese Buddhism was very cautious about Vajrayana. It some strains of it exist, but they did not embrace it the way that the Tibetans did. So Vajrayana, one doesn't really see find it in its pinnacle form in China and Japan. They went many directions actually, which I won't go into. But in Tibet, the Vajrayana teachings, which are said to be able to lead to total enlightenment in one lifetime, that's another huge term, but we can get into that maybe. To meditate on a divine form of transcendent light as illusory is precisely the instruction. If you grasp onto it as really inherently being that way, that's considered catastrophic for one's own mind. So the reason I dared to go into that detail is because for me, it actually was the only key to start to open up the apparently intractable contradictions between the whole of Judeo-Christian worldview as I knew it and the whole of Mahayana Buddhist worldview as I was learning it. That if I could see entire worldviews as still provisional to take us somewhere, but in a positive way, so that if one practices according to that teaching, it'll take you beyond itself. And it's a very fine line, and we're just babies at the possibilities of looking at Christian theology that way and not losing the whole thing. That wouldn't be my point either.
Right. I wonder if this is a healthy way of understanding what Jesus meant by the fulfillment of the law rather than the abolishment of the law.
Beautiful. Yeah. Yeah. And the prophecy of the advocate who will both teach things that I have not been able, I mean, that's Jesus saying, is he will lead you into all the truth. And he will teach you things I'm not ready. I mean, you're not ready for me to teach you now. And that those lines in the last discourses really became like my own North Star of who is the advocate, who is the Holy Spirit, both for me personally, but in our day and age, where the Holy Spirit will continue to teach, and perhaps in the most unexpected places. Yeah. So from a Christian point of view, could we believe that it's actually the Holy Spirit teaching Tibetan Buddhism to the world, which that story alone, how Tibetan Buddhism has spread around the world in the course of the last 60 years as a result of a catastrophic events for their own country and their own tradition.
Well, could you maybe let's focus on practice for a second. Like, so maybe give a concrete example of, let's say, something that's maybe part of your prayer practice or your just engagement with, well, I guess you would say in your engagement with the world, with mm-hmm. with just, you know, things of this world, or even your understanding of discernment. Like, how have you seen those things change as you go deeper in the traditions outside of Judeo-Christianity? Like, what would be something that you were like, oh, this I did not realize was even possible in my prayer life, but now it seems almost so normative and I can't imagine it any other way.
Mm. That's huge. Thank you. One thing I'll say right off that I think can be simply a Christian teaching, which is the idea of a path, a spiritual path, and this is inherent to Christianity from its earliest days. Of course, the followers of the way, as early Christians called themselves, and the teaching of especially the Byzantine tradition that bled into the desert tradition, and then the desert tradition in turn influenced the Byzantine tradition that perhaps expressed most vividly by Saint Simeon in The New Theologian. It's scary to say this, but he said to his monks, don't think that your baptism alone is the guarantee of your salvation. You need to actually have an experience of the Holy Spirit. You need to have experience of the uncreated energies of God vividly within your prayer life. That is how you know that union is being enacted. And when I began to read Simeon the New Theologian in detail, it was already familiar to me from the standards that I had learned in a Tibetan context, frankly. Of course, there have been millions of Buddhists through the centuries who have seen their path as part of a many lifetime process, of course, but also in parts of communities being in service of other parts of communities. I'm saying so, like the lay people who make offerings to the monastics and believe that the virtue by which they're doing that is somehow going to benefit them in future lives, benefit family members in future lives. But the monastics are the ones who in that lifetime have the opportunity to devote themselves wholeheartedly to the Dharma. That's definitely been true throughout the history of Buddhism. But interestingly enough, the way that Tibetan Buddhism came to Western countries, and I'm saying that globally Western countries outside of Tibet itself, it's as if we started to get some of the highest teachings right away, the most demanding teachings right away, which is if you follow a path of personal spiritual transformation, especially with an enormous amount of emphasis on meditation and transforming the mind-body system through meditation, You will see the path unfolding before you of actually transforming who you are. And so that's a challenge, I think, to the Christian churches, because people, as I said earlier, to hold a spiritual path or a faith system in this day and age, it needs to kind of become most of one's life or all of one's life, not be further sidelined into just something you do once a week or like the old Sunday only Christians idea. So the challenge, it's like it reminds Christians what Christianity was about from its earliest days, which is an entirely wholehearted life-giving practice. I mean, as in you give your whole life to it, because nothing, everything else fades. I won't quite say nothing else matters, but that's what I was about to say. Nothing else matters apart from giving oneself to the demands of the gospel. And so as I learned, to come to your question, Father John, as I learned Tibetan Buddhist meditation techniques, not only in how to calm the mind, but also in terms of analysis, in terms of really looking at questions in meditation, having learned different teachings, and then sitting in what's called analytical meditation. And one's totally silent, one's withdrawn from the sensory world, one's not reading, one's not doing anything else, but how to sit with one's mind in silence and actually hammer out a problem. In many cases, that's a lost art, and it would benefit everybody, whether they're religious or not, to learn how to hammer out problems in the silence of the mind that's already been calmed through techniques such as shamatha of calming the mind and body. And then, concomitant with that, but as another part of that path, the idea of what in Buddhism is called guru yoga, or a series of practices in which one is visualizing some form of the ultimate teacher in the space in front of one, sometimes at the crown of one's head, ultimately in the center of one's heart, dramatizing, really, in a wonderful way, dramatizing the relationship with one's sublime teacher. And the practices themselves have such deep parallels to Christian practice. There's nothing foreign about, and I can say some of the elements of it, of making obeisance, singing praises, making offerings, confession, all the same. I mean, the parallels of the elements of confession and absolution in Christianity and the way that's taught in Tibetan Buddhism, it's really extraordinary. It's as if you had a mathematical list of what do you need in order to be purified of sin and to know that you're purified of sin. And they're deeply parallel. And then what's maybe less emphasized sometimes in Christianity, the process of rejoicing in virtue, taking joy in the goodness of oneself and others. And then just really praying that one's aspirations may be fulfilled. And of course, there's that fine line of learning how to pray for what is always good, not the kind of prayer that maybe it'll be answered, maybe it won't. Because sometimes, as we know, our prayers may not, it's not a matter of is it the will of God, but it's sometimes our prayers are not in accord with reality. But when our aspirations are completely in accord with reality, then we can trust that the blessings will come, the grace will flow. So it's a whole method of prayer that I was learning in a Tibetan context, continue to learn in the Tibetan context. And it's so naturally lent itself to Christian meanings. And that's where the integration has been able to happen. As you so rightly said, Dave, it's not like I'm switching spiritual identity on a regular basis. And actually that can start to answer your question about the meditations in the book, Living Resurrected Lives.
Ah, yes, the question from the beginning.
Yeah, that those techniques had become embodied for me personally for so long that I felt confident enough to say, okay, that maybe this can help somebody else. I don't know if that's begun to answer your question, John, but.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I think so. I mean, let's talk about the resurrection. Let's talk about really well, I guess let's just say what your project has been able to kind of delve into in unpacking the relevancy of resurrection for our time. Is that a good way to maybe articulate it?
So the view of emptiness that I spoke about a little bit before goes down to the very nature of a body and a mind. And that's one of its most important fields of application within Buddhism. It's fine to realize that outer phenomena are not inherently what they appear to be, but the most important phenomenon to realize the emptiness of initially is one's own person, one's own identity. And this is so often misunderstood as thinking, oh, you're not there at all, or what does no self mean? You, of course, you're walking around, right? Are you a person? Are you not a person? In no way does it diminish or denigrate, in a dialogue kind of way, the sacredness of the person in a Christian context. I'd say, on the contrary, understanding the lack of inherent identity of the person we think we are, according to these meditations on emptiness in a Buddhist context, opens the limitless possibilities of who we ultimately are and who we can become from the depths of our being. And so, meditating on the emptiness, really, of even any thought that arises, and realizing I don't have to grasp onto that thought as really me or mine. I don't have to identify with mental afflictions, which is that whole range. It's a translation of a Buddhist term, klesha, which is very close to the Greek understanding of logismoi, or the thoughts that obscure our deeper nature. And through a path of meditation, and I'm speaking in the Hesychast tradition or the early desert tradition, one has to banish those thoughts again and again and again, not be controlled by them, in order to allow the natural state of our divinely created being to manifest. And the insight to see that a particular, even negative thought that arises is not something that has to be followed, is not something that has to be identified with or even felt guilty for, that it can be released. And this is speaking in meditation itself, but also outside of meditation. One doesn't have to grasp on to any thought that arises. And the more we see that there can sometimes be a whole community of speakers inside our mind, and we're not necessarily any of them, learning not to think that everything that comes up is me is the first step. At a deeper layer, to start to uncover a stream of pure awareness that is always aware, that is always luminous, that is always sharp. And it's that that is obscured by the myriad thoughts, good or bad, that come up in our mind. And through meditation, to start to be able to rest more and more deeply in that stream of awareness gives us a new layer of who we think we are. But even more deeply than that, and I think anyone who's versed in the Hesychast tradition will see there's language for everything I'm saying within the Hesychast tradition, to start to uncover the presence of the divine awareness that is always there, ubiquitously present, and without which we wouldn't exist at all. So, dare I say, a kind of an existential uncovering of the divine creative presence that's not the object of a syllogism or an argumentation, because things exist, God must exist, but rather, and not simply in a psychological proof either, an experiential opening of the floor, of the ocean floor, as it were, the ground beyond the ground, of existence, moment by moment by moment, opens us to a sense of divine presence that, if cultivated, if dwelt in, if giving one's whole life to, can start to be an experience of union, as we've had the teachings throughout the centuries within Christianity, the path of purgation, the path of illumination, and the path of union. But then that becomes a foretaste of how our minds have never been separate from the divine mind. And so in dying and in death, when everything we thought we are is being stripped from us anyway, that's when nature, as it were, does for us what we have been learning to do through a meditative path. In Tibetan Buddhism, which has extremely detailed teachings on the dying process and what happens after death, from those who have ostensibly experienced it lucidly and then in later incarnations been able to write it down. So that's a whole different story and topic of discussion in terms of Christianity and Buddhism. But the understanding that the coarse mind dissolves into a subtle mind, the subtle mind dissolves into the very subtle mind of clear light. And so the continuum into the future of individual existence, I'll just say it that way in a very broad sense right now, the future of individual existence is, as it were, riding on a stream of consciousness and energy, very subtle energy on which that consciousness rides. And it is individual. It is that person. If theologically we're willing to go there, to push that boundary and to say, even if the physical body that clearly is going to either be burned to ashes or rot or be dismembered, all the things that can happen to physical bodies, which have raised these big philosophical questions through history about what is it that gets raised. If we say that we believe in the resurrection of the body, what body? Which body? Because we have so many of them in the course of a lifetime. Is it the child's body? Is it the adult's body? Is it, and so on. And these are questions that my mother and I went into in the book. But if one can, as it were, pare down one's understanding of the body-mind union to that subtle stream of energy, which in Buddhist context is described as being very subtly physical, and it can move through space, then the transformation that can occur into a new form of existence. And that new form of existence, I think we can almost logically can say, will depend radically on the kind of life a person lived. But if we're speaking of the glorified resurrection, the resurrection of the just, as I'm using classical language here, then it is that mind that has been unified with the divine ground all along that is the basis for the new person, the resurrected person, as that person will be in the future. And I don't really want to go further than that, because then if one gets into further details, the questions are enormous, because again, Buddhism can be so specific sometimes. I mean, almost frighteningly specific about all the options, and there are many options. It's not a bifurcation into heaven and hell. There's a whole panoply of options of what one might become depending on the life one's lived, the way one has viewed life, the prayers one has made, the connections one has made with certain manifestations of the enlightened mind. It's very detailed. And I think the theology of the resurrection in a Christian context probably will have to follow a lot of other evolutions as we're starting to speak about. It can't start with the theology of the resurrection because it's too complex. And in a way, I think that's been the biggest question mark through the history of Christianity, what to do with, what do we actually think resurrection means? And is it something that happens right away, or is it something that souls have to remain in some in-between state until the end of time when they'll be raised in the body? And that raises a host of theological problems. So I don't really want to stop there per se, but the vision that my mother and I were really trying to offer was living resurrected lives. How can our prayer life now be lived in anticipation of a glorified resurrection? And then the more that we are joining our lives with what we know, which is Jesus's resurrection, we at least know something about the way that he manifested and the way he was not limited by physicality as we know it, even though he appeared in a fully physical body. That can stretch the spiritual imagination in a marvelous way to start to say, well, what if we were already living in union with Christ's resurrected, glorified self, which is the only Christ we know now? And how would that change the way we relate to others? I mean, really, all of it has to come back to compassion, open-heartedness, forgiveness, and an ability to see the preciousness of life in every person and sentient being whom we encounter.
I think that, you know, the whole notion of emptiness, I think you've given me a whole new appreciation of. I've always kind of looked at emptiness as a way to kind of rid yourself of something so that you can be made full. But I think that this is a different way of understanding fullness by going to that place of knowing that the essence is of what you think something is actually not it. It's actually something far more profound. And in a certain sense, it's what kind of becomes the ultimate wholeness of everything. If that makes sense. At least it makes sense in my head. So.
The way you expressed it just now is very much in tune, and it's a real difference, even the way emptiness is often spoken about in the Zen tradition and the Tibetan tradition. So
thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Eva. And is there anything else that you maybe would like to share with us to bring people more aware of the work that you're doing, or anything else you would like to, I guess you would say, promote? I mean, don't be ashamed. There's a lot of really great things that you're involved in, or anything that you would be helpful to unpack, to help people greater unpack what we've discussed today.
Yeah, so where my work has led me, work and practice has led me, is where I live now is called the Center for Contemplative Research in Crestone, Colorado. And our website is precisely those words, centerforcontemplativeresearch.org. And we're a long-term retreat center that focuses on really creating the conducive conditions for individuals who are properly trained, have some significant years of meditative experience, retreat experience, to be able to come and do long-term solitary retreats. We live as a community, but we don't see each other very often. Mm. Really, people need to be ready to live in solitude. And with the aspiration to go deeper and deeper into these core practices of shamatha, which is stilling the mind, bringing the mind to that state of non-conceptual stillness that is an ideal vessel or instrument with which to investigate the nature of reality, and that's vipassana. And while our practices are rooted in very specific Buddhist traditional techniques, spiritually, we're wide open to a variety of faith backgrounds and faith commitments. So that we're really trying to model something for the next generation, that contemplative life could become acceptable again as a full-time profession. Mm. And a full-time vocation that doesn't quite look the same as the traditional monastic lives in different traditions. We have both ordained monastics as well as lay people here. And coming to retreat is not necessarily a lifetime commitment. It might be years, but it is certainly a period of intensive training in order to be able to take the discoveries made, the stability gained back into the world to help others.
Beautiful. Thank you so much, Eva.
Thank you.
Thank you, Eva.
Wow. Eva Natanya. I feel like even though I was a part of this conversation and have already listened to it back once, I need to listen again just to get everything that was in there. I'm still chewing on it. She's so good at not just understanding all of the things that she experiences and believes and articulating them, but also to just hold them so well together. This doesn't feel like a forced integration whatsoever. And I'm so grateful to have her to be able to tell us all about that. In our next episode, we're going to be talking with Kitasaro Weinberg, who is a Buddhist who also seems to be able to hold the Christian tradition, particularly the Christian apophatic tradition, together with his Buddhism. Well, I think that's going to do it for us today. Religion to Reality is not just a podcast. It is also an interfaith monthly gathering. We meet for free online for a video gathering once a month, the first Wednesday of each month, and you're very welcome to join. I would love for you to sign up. You can find us on Substack at religiontoreality.substack.com, and that's where you'll be able to find the sign up for the monthly gathering. And you can also subscribe to get blog posts as well as notifications when new episodes come out, which you can, of course, also do on any podcast player that you may be already listening on right now, like Spotify and Apple Podcasts and so forth. Religion to Reality was created and is executive produced by me, Dave Flisky, and is produced and edited by Nick Stropoli and Connor Donnelly. You can find the show notes and other resources at religiontoreality.org.